The following Dharma talk was presented at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota, as part of the weekly Dharma series. The speaker is Mark Nunberg, guiding teacher at Common Ground.
Last Wednesday, I began a series of talks on how to practice, how we can practice in daily life. After spending most of January talking about, more specifically about sitting practice instructions. So last week I just took the basic sitting practice instruction and reflected on, well, what would that look like in an ordinary daily life situation? And the way I had been talking about sitting practice was in terms of four parts: developing the motivation to sit. So like, how do we energize our sitting practice so that we're not just going through the motion, just sort of staying there in the sitting posture, but actually we're actually learning something when we're doing our sitting practice. So we need to be motivated. We need to connect with this wish to be free or this wish to be happy. And then we have to bring it into some kind of training, which in Buddhism, it's usually about the present moment. So with this energy, this motivation, we find over and over again, we have to rediscover or re-wake up to the present moment. Oh yeah, here. This body is like this. This mind is like this. Here and now. And then in order to have any kind of continuity in the present moment, we have to, in a sense, defend ourselves against all of our habit energy, which is, our habit energy is to sweep us into self-centered thinking, self-centered dramas. And so, in Buddhism, we call those the hindrances. So the hindrances have the flavor of greediness or craving, all the stories that are flavored by greed or wanting, all the stories, all the dramas that are flavored by aversion or fear, anxiety, worry, all the stories that are being propelled by restlessness, all the stories, distractions being propelled by dullness in the mind, and all those propelled by doubt. And you can tell, you know, there's a lot of overlap between these five. So these aren't like, they're just five ways of categorizing how the mind gets lost. You could come up with a different category. The Buddha has lots of different. He has the 10 fetters, you know, the 5 hindrances, the 3 poisons, greed, anger, and delusion, you know, and then the 1 basic problem, which is ignorance, not seeing things clearly. So you could divide them up any number of ways. The point is, when we understand the great value of being fully present, then we have to appreciate how much habit energy we have that will pull us out of that moment of being present. So it's not enough just to want to be present. We have to have this intention, this motivation to be present, and then we have to develop skill over time how to remain present, how not to get lost as soon as we sort of briefly pass through the present moment into our next distraction. Between one distraction and the next distraction, there's a moment of knowing, oh, and then we're lost. So like a drowning person, you know, we come up for a breath only to get, you know, pulled under again. So there's, in our sitting practice, and this isn't just once that we discover our motivation or our intention, but probably often in a sit we have to do this. And then we have to remember it's all about the present moment. This is where we do the work of transforming our mind, our heart, in the present moment. And then we need skill. We need to cultivate skill how not to get distracted once we're in the present moment, at least to some degree. And then in doing those three things, staying motivated, coming back to the present moment, not getting lost, not taking the hooks of distraction, then this sort of creeping or growing insight arises, which is, it's like the great shortcut in spiritual life, that it's all about letting go. This just sort of emerges, and sometimes there's really profound clarity that this is what, not just what spiritual life is about, but just what life is about. It's like the secret, the meaning of life is to let go, is to let it be. Now, let go doesn't mean we let go of life. We let go of trying to live our life a particular way. Instead, we're letting go of anything that's in the way of our life living itself. Our personality, allowing our personality to just be our personality, to unfold. As messy, as imperfect as our personality is. I mean, we can get a whiff of freedom just imagine, just using our imagination, like, oh yeah, like if I just allowed my life, my personality to be what it is, like how freeing that would be. The only problem with that is that we somehow think it's inadequate. Like, this isn't the life I want. So we spend our lifetime struggling against our personality, struggling against our circumstances. So then what we get for our life is we get our personality, we get our circumstances, and we get the struggle. So maybe somehow there's a way to jettison the struggle and realize that this personality and this set of circumstances is actually perfect for realizing freedom, the freedom of peacefully coexisting with our karma, our circumstances, our conditions. It may not fit some idealized notion of our life, but it's actually fine. Or the only thing that makes it not fine is that we have other ideas. And then we have a war on our hands. So, over the next few months, I'm just going to come at daily life practice from different angles, and I'm hoping that people will give me suggestions too. Somebody last week mentioned that it would be nice to look at the whole area of money as a place for practice. So some night we'll do that, maybe even a couple weeks on that. But tonight I thought just more generally, like how to practice, some basic strategies for practicing in daily life, or how to take what we do when we're formally sitting, doing sitting meditation, and what does that look like in daily life? And one of the most obvious ways to practice in daily life is it's very simple to remember at least, which is slowing down. So I'm going to talk about that tonight, how we can use the simple instruction of slowing down or simplifying just in little ways, so not in a big way, because it can get really burdensome actually. And stinky. It's like if we think, oh, all I need to do is slow down, or people who slow down are good, you know, they're holy, and the people who are rushing, they're the bad ones. You know, and then it can get really stinky where, you know, I notice this with my wife. It's like a lot of the things that I'd like to cultivate in myself but haven't been so successful at, when I see her doing those things, you know, it really pushes my buttons. I mean, it's like I'd like to cultivate more mindfulness when I'm eating, not to just eat unconsciously. And so I tend to eat unconsciously, at least some of the time. And so whenever I see my wife eating unconsciously, it like I get mad. And it's so funny because it's not about her eating unconsciously; it's that I don't like that experience myself. And this is like what we do whenever we take something on with the wrong intention. So the whole point of tonight's talk, when I suggest this possibility that we just play with slowing down, find a way to skillfully play with slowing down in our lives, it's because we can learn something. So it isn't because it's like ultimately good. It isn't. There's nothing inherently good, better about being slow than there is about being fast. Meaning we can be a fast saint, a saint that rushes. They could refer to us that way, the rushing saint, the multitasking saint of Minneapolis, who lived in the early part of the 21st century. But in order to become that multitasking, rushing saint, it might be beneficial to practice slowing down. Like, we can rush slowing down, because we'll learn how to be peaceful if we slow down, and then we can take it, you know, in a sense on the road into the busy times of our day, the places where it wouldn't be so appropriate to slow down. So I thought I'd read from one of our American saints. Did you know that some of those guys back in the late 1800s were reading Buddhism? People like Thoreau and Emerson and a couple other of those, what they call themselves, the transcendentalists. So here's from Thoreau, from Walden. There were times when I could not afford to sacrifice the bloom of the present moment to any work, whether of the head or hand. I loved a broad margin to my life. Sometimes in a summer morning, having taken my accustomed bath, I sat in my sunny doorway from sunrise to noon, wrapped in reverie amidst the pines and hickories and sumacs, in undisturbed solitude and stillness, while the birds sang around or flitted noiseless through the house, until by the sun falling in at my west window or the noise of some traveler's wagon on the distant highway, I was reminded of the lapse of time. I grew in those seasons like corn in the night, and they were far better than any work of the hands would have been. They were not time subtracted from my life, but so much over and above my usual allowance. I realized what the Orientals mean by contemplation and the forsaking of works. For the most part, I minded not how the hours went. The day advanced as if to light some work of mine. It was morning, and lo, now it is evening, and nothing memorable is accomplished. Instead of singing like the birds, I silently smiled at my incessant good fortune. As the sparrow had its twill sitting on the hickory before my door, so I had my chuckle, or suppressed warble, which he might hear out of my nest. So it's nice to have this ritual of sitting practice and to really have it real clear in our mind what that means, what it means to sit, to really take on the formal practice, because then we'll know how to have those moments in our daily life to really get a sense. And I thought, you know, the way that Thoreau described, I mean, basically he spent a day meditating. That's what he was talking about. Meditation isn't about following the breath or naming our experience. It's about learning this radically simple way of being. So what does it mean to be, not to be a doer, but just to be? And we can find this, of course, in any moment. And again, it's not even so much that we have to do something. This is one of the real tricks that we need to learn in our daily life. And actually, in some ways, it's easier in daily life than in our formal sitting practice. Because our formal sitting practice is called something, like meditation, you know, it feels like we should do something when we're sitting here. And that doing often gets in the way. But it's also problematic to not do something, because the force of our habit will cause us to do something. So generally the instruction we get when we're meditating is, here is something you can do, so you don't do what you would otherwise do if I don't tell you what to do. So the teacher tells us something to do, like feel your body sitting. Be really intimate with your body sitting, or feel the breath moving in the body. Or hear sounds just as they are, let them come and go, without thinking about the sounds or imagining where it's coming from, just know hearing. So we are given instructions so that we don't continue to analyze and worry and plan and judge and all the other things that we would do because of habit. And so it's hard to come into this more profound kind of presence, just being. that actually in some way, surprisingly, it's easier in daily life. Because what happens is we're completely absorbed in some task, fixing something, getting to work, eating, and then that task is over, or something just interrupts that obsessive activity, where we're just absorbed in it, but not in a wholesome way absorbed, not a kind of being intimate. Because being intimate implies that we're there, and we know we're there, but mostly we're just lost in the activity. It's just we're there in the habit of the activity, but not in the awareness of the activity. But in daily life, what happens is things get interrupted because there's so much going on. So we may be absorbed in something, and then something falls, or the phone even rings, or that activity is over. And all of those breaks, you know, those transitions, you can notice sort of shining through or breaking through is that quality of stillness. It's like there is a moment from the mind being obsessed in this activity, thinking about this, worrying about something, and when it does something else, there's a moment between those two obsessive patterns. And we can begin to see, realize really, wake up to a quality of being before we then get pulled under again, start to drown, get absorbed into some activity. But we won't recognize those moments unless we've had some experience, like in a sitting practice. This is the real value of sitting practice. Still, we're not going to have too many of those moments even in sitting practice, a normal sit. But the more we sit, the more we train the mind to do something so it doesn't do what it normally does, so we get some continuity with a very simple activity that we're giving the mind to do, like being with the breath, being with the breath. Then, because it's such a simple activity to know the sensations of the in and out breath, there will be natural moments, not something that you do. There'll just be natural moments as you're just knowing the breath going in and out, where you realize, the mind will realize, or the heart will realize, that it doesn't have to be the person knowing the in and out of the breath. And that will just fall away. And there will just be the knowing of the in and out of the breath without there being a mark who's meditating on the in and out breath. There will just be the natural activity of breathing in and knowing the breath coming in and breathing out and knowing the breath going out. And that will feel very freeing and wonderful. That moment of just the flow of knowing, of being. And see, when we know that then in meditation practice, it leaves a real imprint on the heart and the mind. It's like the Buddha calls this the taste of freedom. He talks about the practice of being mindful, this awareness practice, of having only one taste, the taste of freedom. Or, you know, to use another metaphor, the taste of weightlessness. The self has no weight. The sense of being has no weight. It's like a free fall or a lightness in the heart as opposed to heaviness in the heart when we're in the flow, when it's just activity being known. And then once we have that flavor, once we, to whatever degree, no matter how faint that insight is, but once we get a sense of that experience of lightness, of freedom, then we can just, it's mostly a matter of remembering it as we go through our day. And what can support that is just slowing down a little bit. In fact, the wanting to remember freedom, the wanting to remember this freedom of just being, of just activity happening, whether it's fast activity or slow activity, it's the intention to remember which is what slows us down. And as I mentioned at the beginning, it's not even so much that we actually physically slow down, but it's more like an inner softness, this remembering. Or a kind of quality that, even if we're rushing, but that the activity is not what's most important. You know, mostly when we're blind, when we're living out of habit, it's like it's all about getting to the end of the activity. Whatever it is we're doing. If we're cooking, it's all about we're cooking in order to get done with cooking. And then as soon as we're eating in order to get done with eating. And then we're doing the dishes in order to get done with doing the dishes. And basically, we're living our life to get done with our life. And from a Buddhist point of view, to get on with the next life. And then from a deeper Buddhist view, this life after life after life, this ongoing samsara, cycles of suffering existences, you know, this is what eventually wakes us up like, isn't there a better way than living in order to get done with whatever's next? So this remembering freedom then is the beginning of our unhooking from this basic ignorance, which is, I'll be happy when I get done with this, when I get this, when I get through this. When I get through the week and it's Friday, then I'll be happy. When I get into my middle years and I have some money in the bank, and I have a house and a family, I'll be happy. When I get to retirement, I'll be happy. You know? Well, how many times have we made ourselves that promise? You know, and how many times are we going to believe it again? So when we start having this sense of freedom, then it really encourages us to move through our life with a different attitude. And one way to support that remembering is just to slow down a little bit. So that the slowing down is so we're looking for those moments of space, of freedom. And any moment will do. So we don't need a special moment. Any moment will do. That's the insight that we have. When, whether it's in a formal sitting practice or wherever we have that insight, the insight is this deep recognition that it's okay. But it's not just it's okay, it's like it's really okay. Meaning that the appropriate response for the human heart is to trust and relax. Now normally our habit energy is it's not okay to relax and trust until we get the life we think we need. Until we have the body we want, the relationships we want, the situation we want, then I'll relax. But it's not okay to relax now. So we basically justify a tight, heavy, constricted heart. Because we're not there yet. Anybody think they're there yet? Right? We don't think we're there yet. And we believe that this is the sort of ultimate arrogance. Like we're so sure. I mean, it's kind of ironic. We're pretty sure that we're confused human beings. But on this point, we're not confused. We know with certainty we're not there yet, right? And that we should struggle until we get there. So this is why we're kind of lost until we start having some kind of insight, some intuitive experience that suggests something other than that. Like, oh, maybe it's already okay. As Thich Nhat Hanh says, peace is available. Please help yourselves. And actually, slowing down is a nice way to challenge the... This is one of the best things about slowing down. And I don't mean pervasively through your life. The best way is just to choose a few places in your life where you want to do this. Like, it could be as simple as when I walk up and down the stairs at my house or in my apartment, I'm just going to practice slowing down a little bit. So, the great thing about that is when you slow down as you're walking down the stairs, I used to practice with these stairs every once in a while, I still remember. But for a while, I was really religious about whenever I'd go up and down those stairs, I'd really practice. I try to practice. I try to remember to practice. And it's not so much that slowing down itself is that useful, because we can be just as lost in thought, and maybe even more lost in thought, slowing down. But because it's not our habit to slow down, when we slow down, we see so much of our habit to rush. We get to see something we wouldn't otherwise see. This incessant habit to push, to drive, to strive, to get. And we begin to see, well, this doesn't seem so necessary, you know? Why? And Because that inherent peace, that inherent space, that possibility of just being, it's not so much that we have to create that. In fact, we don't have to create that at all. We just have to have the conditions that allows that to be seen. And to have those moments where that can be seen, we have to have moments where we're not caught up in habit energy. So when we slow down, when we take on this practice of slowing down in places in our life, we'll see exactly the habit energy we need to let go of. We'll see the habit energy that's driving us to rush, to do, to analyze again, to remember, to plan. And we can put it down. Because in that moment, we'll see it's unnecessary. And it could just drop. And this is where a lot of people have insight. So many of my deeper insights have been exactly this sort of situation where I'm doing some activity, and in the context of that activity, a big wave of habit energy arises. But because I'm mindful, I see that big wave of habit energy to do or to judge myself or to doubt. And so that habit energy arises in the space of simple, clear mindfulness, presence. And when the mind, that clear knowing, sees habit energy, it sees habit energy as it is, which is just a house of cards. So the habit energy falls apart. And before something else can construct itself, another habit energy, there's a moment. And because the mindfulness is really there, then the mindfulness knows what's there when there isn't habit energy in the mind, which is just that space, that profound space of the present moment, or whatever you want to call it, that does nothing but sort of expresses this, it's okay. It's really okay. So this is, so anything we can do in our daily life that kind of throws a little curve to our habit energy. And this is why people like to go on trips, you know, travel or learn new things or go new places, is that they don't have any habit energy for that place. So they feel more free. I don't know if people are necessarily conscious of this. Some people are, I'm sure. But, you know, even in a lot of spiritual traditions, there's a big emphasis on pilgrimages. In the Thai forest tradition that this center has influenced a lot, the more recent development in Thai Buddhism over the last 100 years, they sort of reinstated this Tudung, it's called, where the monks or nuns would leave their monasteries and even leave their sort of being with other monks, and they just go on their own, not stay in any place for more than one day. That's how the Buddha taught, that the monks, at least at times, they should practice not staying in any one place more than one or two days. So they're just on the move. And because of that, their habit energy isn't so active, because they're constantly in new environments, new situations. But you know how it is with the people we know well? I mean, we can totally be on automatic pilot with those people because we know how to interact with them. And we can go unconscious so much more easily. So this is another place to slow down. People that you see regularly, like if you're a parent, one of your kids, just take one of your kids or your partner or one of your good friends that you see regularly during the week and just slow down the interaction a little bit. They may not even notice, so it can be almost imperceptible. But you're just not rushing into your habits of how you would relate. You know, you always talk to this person about their day, or you always talk to this person about their relationship, or about some movie that they saw or you saw. So maybe you just don't follow that impulse, and just have a few moments of silence and see what happens, see what that's like. Or when that person stops before immediately saying something, just really notice that moment. doesn't mean you're not going to say something in a few seconds, but just let there be a gap. It can be really nice. And then if one of your friends is somebody who practices, you can actually together take this on. You know, just to voluntarily put in, allow gaps to arise in your conversations, in your moments together. And just to slow things down as you're relating together, as you're doing things together. There are many places to practice, of course. Many ways. Another way is just to literally stop your body every day, several times a day. Find different ways to completely stop your body. So you basically have, you know, where Thoreau had the whole day, you know, well, we may not be able to have a whole day, but can we have a few minutes where we're not doing anything, where we're practicing not doing anything? We're not even meditating. So it's not even that. Don't even tell yourself this is the time to meditate. You're just sitting there. That's it. So like, it could be when you, if you drive your car every day, it could be that you make it a point. You can even paste a little note, get a sticky note, put it on your steering wheel to remind yourself, you know, say something, or somebody else uses your car, you can put it in code so nobody thinks you're weird. You know, just about, you know, it could be, wait a moment. And so you get in your car, you know, and before you start it up, before you put the seatbelt on, you just sit down and you just completely, fully land in the moment. Okay. Oof. And so all of the unfinished business, you know, that's around, it's just going to come crashing down on you. Just let the whole thing crash down on you. So you let your mind do what it does. You let your body do what it does. You let reactions happen, like, oh, this is stupid. I got to get somewhere, you know. And you just let that all happen. So you're not picking any of it up. This is what being is. And then if you have enough wherewithal, then in all of that activity that's going to be happening as you're just sitting there for 20, 30 seconds, right? If that's all that needs to be. And, there, you know, you can make it longer, but it doesn't need to be longer than 20, 30 seconds. But every time there's a wave of mental activity, notice how it blooms and then it ends. And notice the gap. There's always a gap between one little storm. Oh, I forgot to do. And the next time, oh, I better get. There's a little gap. And you can actually get very interested in those gaps. And seeing those gaps puts all of that activity into perspective. It's like the whole world emerges from emptiness. You know, and all of a sudden we got this drama. And if we don't take a hold of it, that drama falls apart. And there's that emptiness, that empty space of the present moment, which has no form. And then out of that empty lack of form comes the next drama, the next thought, the next reaction or whatever. And then that falls away. And after a while, you know, we start getting involved, we get drawn in. Some thought, some reaction captures the attention, and we get lost. And before we know it, we realize we're on the highway. We didn't even realize that we put the seatbelt on and we started the car. We just did that unconsciously because we were so absorbed in our thoughts, and we just went on automatic pilot. But that's okay. So fine, you might even want to choose a few places where you can practice stopping. Or if you have an office where you can close the door, you know, you can go into your office and you can just lie down on the floor. That's even better than sitting. Because just the posture, that relaxation of lying flat on the floor, it really supports the, you know, the body and the mind, they mirror each other. So if we just allow the body to completely stop, to let go, so we're not even expending muscular energy to be upright in a sitting posture, then that actually supports the mind just letting go. So the gaps might be more obvious when we're lying down. There still will be the same kind of dramas coming and going, but we might notice the gap a little bit more because the body is more relaxed, then that gap might last a little longer before the next drama comes in, captures the attention. So just notice that space. Even now when I'm talking, you know, between the words, there's space. Between your thoughts, between whatever's going on in your mind, in your body, there's space. In fact, everything, the whole existence, the whole world, is this play between form and emptiness. Some of you probably have done some practice at one of the Zen centers in town, and one of the things that they chant at a lot of the Zen centers, one of the Mahayana sutras. So this is some of the sutras in the Mahayana tradition came up after the time of the historic Buddha. So the Heart Sutra is one of them. It's a beautiful teaching about form and emptiness and how they play together. And they're not really different from one another. And this is something we need to wake up to. It's not something we just chant, but it's something we want to actually see in our experience. As a deluded, as an ignorant human being, the Buddha would say that our mind is fixated just on the form. And because the mind never sees the other half of reality, we have a confused relationship to form, because we take form to be the whole shebang, and so we grasp it. But when our mind is more attentive, more mindful, we see form and we also see emptiness. We see the space of the present moment, and then we see form, and then we see space, and then we see form. We see both, and so our relationship to form radically changes. We don't cling to form anymore because we understand emptiness. And so we know now how to participate in a world of form, which is to be fully there, fully engaged, intimate, without the clinging, without the grasping. Because we understand that it's not really different than emptiness. It's nothing worthy of clinging. And this is, we can get just by slowing down. We start to learn this. In fact, rushing is just a manifestation of taking life too seriously. So, to slow down, even if we don't believe it when we slow down, if we slow down, we're going to really see that habit of taking life seriously. And we can, and then just be mindful of it. And we'll see that drama of taking life seriously. We'll see it arise, like, yeah, this is serious, and then it will fall away. And we'll see the mind that doesn't have that thought in it. We'll actually see the space of the present moment without that view. This is serious. It's my life. It's serious. I mean, can you have that view continuously? Try that as an experiment. Can you have, like, let's just assume most of us think that life is serious. This is my life and it's serious. But we can't have that view continuously in the mind. It arises and we think, yeah, my life is serious, but we don't notice when it falls away. We're not paying close enough attention. Like, what is the mind, what is the space of the present moment when we don't have that view that this is serious, it's my life? So that's really what we're noticing, that we can provoke that insight by slowing down a little bit in life. Maybe I'll just mention one last point. And we could talk about this one more week, probably, just about slowing down and voluntary simplicity in parts of our life. So not about changing our whole life, but just in different places of our life. The one thing, too, is to notice the effect of rushing on the body. And you'll probably find that when you're rushing, You armor your body in a very particular way that you've developed out of habit. And so the more you can recognize that, then that can itself become a cue for us. When we're in that mode, life is serious, I got to rush, we'll wake up. So for me, I do something with my shoulder in a particular way. And so I'll notice that, I don't have to live with this stance. And so this other stance is like, it's provocative for my mind, because it's like, I feel comfortable with this stance. Life is serious, got too much to do, you know. And we sort of feel quite justified being tight and aggressive and competitive and helpless and all the different sort of reactive tendencies that we have. And so when we undo that body armoring, we feel a little naked. And this also can make it so that we're more likely to notice the space. Because when we're in our normal stance, our armored stance, it sort of really supports delusion. It's like it helps us only see the drama and not the space between the dramas. But when we relax the body, undefend it, unarmor it, then it just becomes more apparent. The dramas aren't as seductive then, because they rely on the body reflecting the mental activity of being caught up. So really notice that. So then, just to review, we have three basic strategies that you can work with this next, well, for the rest of your life, but especially for the next few weeks as we talk about it together. One is slowing down. Find a particular place that you want to actually slow down. And again, it's less about the speed at which you do something, but it's an inner softness in the activity itself, so that you're not doing the activity to get it done. So it could be dishes, it could be brushing your teeth, it could be the stairwell, it could be saying goodbye. If you live with someone, when you say goodbye, just slowing that down, or when you say hello, when you get back together at the end of the day, you know, really slowing it down, like really being there instead of just acting it out of habit. So slowing down, finding a few moments every day to stop, to completely stop and to practice not doing anything. So to lie down somewhere or to sit down somewhere where you're not going to be seen in a way that will feel weird. And just stay there for at least 20 or 30 seconds. And just let the whole, I like this word that Jon Kabat-Zinn uses, the whole catastrophe of the moment do what it does. So slowing down, stopping. And then the third activity that you can use is get a sense of how the body feels when we're rushing. And then once you get that, once you know that, then you can consciously, regularly, as often as you can remember, undefend the body, unarmor the body, and notice that feeling of being a little bit more naked, more present, when you're not tensing like you normally tense. So it might be your jaw, might be your shoulders, might be your anus, belly. So there are different ways that we armor the body. So you just have to learn for yourself how your body has kind of mirrors the mental agitation, the mental tension. And we have about 12 minutes now to hear from each other. You probably, inevitably, hopefully, have learned a lot in your life already about some of the things I've talked about. Or, of course, if you have any questions about what I've talked about, anything come to mind? Tom and then Mona? Good point, but it's not, of course, it's not about me, and I think people understand that, because I'm just parroting what I've learned from my teachers, you know, and they were parroting what they learned from their teachers, and on like that. But I think the real point you're saying is that it's really nice to be reminded of these teachers, these teachings, and we need to find ways to remember. That's the key, because the basic problem is we keep forgetting. And if we could somehow remember through the day, it would really be helpful. And that's, so really, it's a, just experiment like how you can remind yourself. Like I would, for a time, I would write little notes and just put them in my pocket. So then when I put my hand in my pocket, I wouldn't have to take it out and read it. I'd remember what the note said, you know, and it was great. It's just to be reminded. So you could find ways, put notes different places, listen to talks in the car, you know, get some good Dharma talks, play them in the car, cultivate friendships with people who are into the practice so that when you hang out with them, inevitably you talk about suffering, and not just suffering and suffering's bad, but suffering and how you work skillfully with it and how you're learning from it. It really helps. Friendship is really important. Just like the friendship we have when we come together on a Wednesday night, you know, you can find many ways to sort of recreate this in your own life, including talking to yourself, not out loud, because you'll end up in a hospital somewhere. But you can be your own Dharma coach. You can remind yourself of what you've discovered is true from your own observation, from hearing other people, and then seeing it in your own life. So, thanks, Tom.
Your imitation of Mark is that it's almost the highest form of compliment. And that's how we learn, that's how children learn, is by imitating. And so life is kind of like a game of leapfrog. And I was just reading about some material and they have a term that's alleluia, which is a high form of awareness and following the divine path. How they teach and do imitation, and how the children learn once they're gone, that it's passed on to the next generation. I think it's not just worry, and you know, to be mindful and present. So, and that's basically, you know, it's just like imitation.
Yeah. Follow. And the key with the imitation, and I totally agree, is that we want to imitate the deepest part. So it's like we could look at the surface, you know, and we see a teacher or somebody that we respect, and on the surface they may behave a certain way, and so we'll imitate that. But what we really want to do is get almost a visceral sense of some kind of ease that we see in another person. And it may be we see Mary is really at ease when she's with her kids, and this other person, you know, Bonnie's really at ease when she's, you know, doing this activity, and this person's really at ease, like Wynn, my wife, she's really at ease in places where she's being asked to be generous. That she doesn't have a lot of stinginess that I see. So for me, that's a real model for me. Like I see that she has a lot of freedom in this particular area. So we can have a lot of different gurus, because our friends, you know, generally have certain places in their lives where they're really stuck and certain places in their lives where they're not stuck much. And we can begin to just sort of see that and try to, it's almost like a sympathetic resonance. And it works the other way too, like if we're around really hateful people, we can start to sympathetically resonate with their hatred and we start getting agitated in that way. So we have to, you know, we have to find ways to sort of protect ourselves so we don't pick up the vibrations that are not so wholesome, but we do tune into the vibrations that are wholesome. Mona, you had a thought?
My son is, you know, older and out of the house for about 10 years. One thing that I'm aware of in my like practice here with mindfulness is that when we're together, I do like all the talking. I just talk. And I think that ultimately I don't feel that as connected as I did when he was young. And my way of trying to connect, and so I consciously have been trying to not talk and leave some space there for him to talk. Then I find he doesn't, and then the silence just makes me kind of start again, because I don't know, because then I feel like I've lost him.
Yeah.
You know, this, I don't know, I need to let more silence be there, even if it just stays silent, or get a eye contact, and, you know, I want to feel connected. Right.
that experience of connection with your son may require you to not be confused by various emotions. So when there are moments of silence when he's there with you, or even when he's not there with you, you might need to let any kind of neediness or any kind of wanting a response from him to sort of arise and pass away. And you may discover that deep feeling of love and connection you have with your son. But it's like we don't find it because we want to find it. We find it by just seeing what's, like, if it's really there, you don't need to do anything. He doesn't need to do anything. But we kind of don't trust that. So we want to make it, we want to make a special moment happen instead of finding a deep feeling of connection that might already be there. So you can practice like not so much being concerned about where he's at, because can anybody stop you from being connected with your son? Can any situation stop you from being connected with your son?
No, not at a heart level. No.
Right. So then it's just a matter of discovering what's true, and that discovery process is basically about not being confused by the stuff on the surface, which can be quite dramatic, you know, like a feeling of having lost your son. I mean, I would imagine this is tough for parents in general to have had such a profound kind of relationship, which is also a relationship of dependency. You know, the parent is taking care of the kid, and then, you know, the kid grows up, they go away. And for the parent, the intimacy has so much been associated with this dependent relationship. But of course, the intimacy isn't actually about that particular dynamic of me being the parent, you being the child. It's really about intimacy. And so, so you have to go beyond the mother-child, mother-son, and all of the baggage that inevitably gets accumulated with that or any kind of powerful relationship, and just feel your love that you have for him. You know, you just want him to be well. But you might have to feel, you might have to see any feelings about what you need, what you think you need from him. But even if you really need him to love you, it doesn't actually stop you from loving him. But if you get confused by your need for him to be a particular way or to treat you a particular way, if your mind kind of fixates on that drama, you will never feel your love you have for him, because you're on this level wanting some kind of response, wanting some kind of experience. So you have to just allow that stuff, like I said before, that wave to crash over you maybe several times, and then after you learn not to be so concerned with that wave of what you might feel you need, you might discover that you have tremendous love, and it's quite beautiful and healing just to feel the love you have for your son. And then who knows, maybe he'll respond to it, maybe he won't. But it won't matter so much, because you love him anyway, you know, even if he's the kind of son who doesn't respond. Todd?
For years, I've found moments in between rest to be really blissful, that stillness. And actually breathing again gets me a little agitated.
Yeah.
A little agitated when the movement starts again. And then I relax into the breath, and it's nice. And talking to other people, I find people either seem to like the stillness or the movement. It's the same in music, the stillness between notes or the notes. But for me, I'm working on finding the continuity so that the stillness is blissful, and I don't want to get attached to that. And also, I don't want kind of the disjointed effects of breathing again, and that it's almost a little jolting.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, breathing thousands of times a day. I'd like to just ease into it, get more continuity.
Yeah, I mean, sense experience is jolting, and the more sensitive we become, it's like, as a sensory being, as a sensitive being, we are bombarded by sense experience, by sense contact, whether it's the in-breath or out-breath, or hearing or seeing or thoughts. So it's an agitating realm that we're in. And it may be that you're just that sort of degree of insight and sensitivity sort of coming online for you. And what this is generally categorized as, if you're interested, is like, it's like insight into dukkha. So insight into dukkha, into suffering, exists on many levels, from gross to subtle. This is a subtle insight into dukkha, just that that experience itself is agitating. And stillness is really satisfying. But if you take the unpleasantness of sense experience personally, then you're in the suffering realm. You don't have to take it personally. It is unpleasant, though, but it doesn't have to be personal. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And after this, Tony, we'll have to end.
I've been thinking about that, the space in between.
Mm-hmm. And make sure they can hear you in the back of the room.
The best I can do is, I'm not a very good artist. In fact, I'm the worst painter in the world. But I can call painting and losing sight of the self. And I'm thinking that that space in between is a space where there's not a perception of the self, but a perception of an experience that's positive. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and I think it's important to experiment, like what sort of activities support that. I mean, for some people it might be basketball, and others knitting, and others painting, and you know, others just sitting there on the couch. But for other people, sitting on the couch might be conducive of a lot of anxiety. But once they start knitting, then actually the space, the inherent stillness or space, just becomes more apparent. So a little bit what Todd was saying too, sort of another point that you were making, Todd, too, that some people, they're going to be more likely to find the stillness in activity, and other people are more likely to have the insight in being more physically still, like in meditation practice. So if you interview a lot of long-time meditators, some people, like some percentage, maybe even 50%, will say that the real insights didn't come on the cushion or on the chair when they were meditating. It came in transitions, you know, when they were doing something else. And the other half will say that the deeper insights came in the middle of a sitting practice. And it just seems to vary depending on people's personalities. And that's why in this tradition there's a lot of emphasis on walking practice, because it's more like daily activity. So monks and nuns and lay people through the ages would alternate when they're on retreat, when they have more time, between sitting and walking practice. And basically, the whole life becomes practice. I mean, that's the ideal. Not that you spend your whole day sitting. But we'll pick it up again next week. Let's just take a few seconds and let go of the words. And appreciate being here together and these very practical teachings that have been passed down for such a long time, generation by generation. And appreciating all the forces that allow us to have this center and this community, having the aspiration to live in a way, to practice in a way that supports peace in our hearts and peace in the world. It's a cause for freedom from suffering for all beings. May all beings be at ease.